Are you the same people that were here this morning? In that case, let's just assume we're taking up where we left off. During our break that stretched out, but we didn't know it was going to, I had several people ask questions, but I'm only going to mention one here because it's in writing, and it hasn't changed in my mind since the time it was asked to me. The other things, I'm not sure exactly what was said. But we have one here, and I think I had permission to tell who this was by, didn't I? She may not even be here. Thank you. Hope that was Becky. There you are, right close. This is from Becky McKinney, an excellent question. We have several biblical examples of godly women who worked out of the home, to include Deborah, Lydia, Dorcas, and the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. How do you resolve these examples with your interpretation of Titus 2:5, keepers at home? Again, a very excellent question, and I hope you can remember the things we were saying about Titus 2:5 this morning. This expression, keepers at home, comes to us from one Greek word, oikouros, and that word is made out of two other words, one word for work and one word for house. The sphere of a woman's life is her home. That's her domain. Doesn't mean that she has to be there 24 hours a day. Doesn't mean she can never leave it. But the home is the sphere of her life. It's not that she's simply to be home, but that the home is her sphere. The Proverbs 31 woman obviously left home when she needed to buy a field. She went afar to find things that would help her family. She did what was needed to be done, but the focus of everything was the home. That's where she poured her life. She got up early. She went to bed late. She was a homemaker, a housekeeper, a homekeeper. You know, back many years ago in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, I used to canvass up and down the streets near the Gregory Boulevard Meeting House in Raytown, canvass for VBS, and I would talk with mothers and children. The children would come out of the home where their mother were, and they would follow me in droves around the neighborhoods and help me pass out flyers. They weren't from the church, but they'd help me pass out flyers for the VBS, and then they would come to the VBS. In just a few years after that, it got to the place where at most houses there was nobody home. It was a striking change. The mothers were working away from the home, and the children were farmed out wherever they could be. Many women don't want to be workers at home. Satan has sold that system on this subject, and many women shirk their God-given responsibility in this area. The husband is to be the provider for the family, that 1 Timothy 5 makes clear. He that provideth not his for his own has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Now, I know that times have changed. Technologically, we today have a lot of wonderful things that they didn't have in the homes of the ancient people. You're obviously, in most cases, not in there with a stone pot grinding the grain to make flour. And you're not down at the creek slapping your clothes against a rock to wash them. You're not spinning thread so that you can make fabric, so that you can sew garments. I know there's more time now, but we need to be very careful that we use that time in a discreet manner. There may be things outside the home that you can do that will assist the home and assist others. And that may be very enterprising things, like the Proverbs 31 woman, and that will bring in income. But any of those kinds of things that you do, the home remains the constant and ongoing priority. Everything focuses on that. When your children are grown and gone, you have a certain freedom. But even then, you don't lose the responsibility for the home. It's still supposed to be a haven for your husband. It's still a place where you can show hospitality. You may have opportunity to wash the saints' feet and do every good work and still do something noble outside the home as an adjunct to your life. But you need to be careful that you don't get yourself into a position where you are tempted. Women who work outside the home have many more extramarital affairs compared with women who are at home. Often they find that they are subject to somebody else's husband other than their own. So we need to make wise choices with the freedom that we have in terms of time. We need to choose well in the use of our gifts and talents and abilities. We need to choose wisely so that we don't compromise ourselves in any way. A woman's responsibility is in the home. That's where her opportunity is to have the greatest impact on the world. A woman doesn't impact the world by getting her laptop and going downtown. She impacts the world by raising up a godly generation of new men and women. There are lots of judgment calls involved in deciding what is best in your personal situation. And people come to me with these kind of questions all the time. What if I have an opportunity to be gone for 2 hours in the morning, do this and that, and the kids will be here? You know, the answer to all of that is that if it enhances and enriches the life in the home, if it accomplishes all of the spiritual goals, if it does not negatively impact your home, then that's between you and the Lord and your husband and your children to work those things out. When you understand the plan and the pattern that God has laid out, then the specifics of how it fleshes itself out in your home are for you and your loved ones to work out. But what grieves me is the massive onslaught that tries to stamp out the idea of women staying home. And I think maybe we're doing a little better on that than we used to a few years ago. There was a time when that was almost looked down on. It was in feminist circles, but even in some Christian circles, it was sort of looked down on for a woman to stay in her home. Vivian Gornack, the feminist author from the University of Illinois, said, and this is a direct quote, "Being a housewife is an illegitimate profession. The heart of radical feminism is to change that." Now, why do they care? You know, that's the thing I've never fully understood. Why does some feminist care whether you're a homemaker or not? Why does she care? But I think I can tell you part of the answer why. It's because her agenda is not only her agenda. It's the agenda of the enemy with a capital E. It's the anti-God agenda that is intended to destroy all we hold dear. The home is where a woman provides the expressions of love for her husband and children. The home is where she leads and guides and teaches and raises up that next godly generation. The home is where she is protected and secure from outside influences and potentially wicked relationships and abuses. The home is where she lodges strangers and washes saints' feet and shows hospitality and devotes herself to every good work. The home is her sphere. I'm going to close with this significant thought. In the 7th chapter of the book of Proverbs, the 11th verse, talking there about a prostitute, or at least a woman who's behaving like a prostitute and is in the attire of a prostitute, she is not only boisterous and rebellious, but the statement is made there in verse 11 that her feet do not remain at home. She's not content with that domain. She's not content with just that man. So she's out exploring other options. At this point, I'm going to stop and ask Becky if you want to say something. I forgot this morning to ask if you had any questions or anything, so we didn't take any, but it is a class, so feel free to ask anything if you want. You want to say anything? Oh, okay, I guess not. Anybody else want to ask or say anything with regard to anything along the anything we've talked about so far? We've got one there, Bill.
There in Titus, 2 and 5, is it?
Yes,
that,
probably.
Teach the younger women to love their husbands, also to love their children.
Right.
Children's part of this. Are we, you mentioned the fact that farming out our responsibility. Are we farming out the responsibility of the mother and the father to the church to teach spiritual things to the children?
That often happens, yes. The responsibility of teaching the children about spiritual things is in the home. Fathers are given this responsibility. Mother helps out with this task, and it is their responsibility. Too often, through the years and now, people have thought that the church was somehow going to take care of that responsibility with a little class once in a while. But it doesn't happen. If they're going to learn spiritual things at all, they're going to learn them from you, and it's going to be done primarily in the home. Excellent point, Bill. Thank you very much. Anybody else want to comment on any of that? Well, Joyce has something there.
I know full well what you're saying about a few years back, how people made you feel bad if you stayed at home, and I started fighting back with the comment. And right now, I treasure every moment I spent with my boys in staying home.
Yeah.
It was a challenge for my husband at times, but we made do, and we're blessed for it. And I advise everyone to think twice and do spend that time with your children and grandchildren.
Thank you very much for that, Joyce. And you're not alone in that sentiment. I just heard a mother say the other day to her adult married daughter, who has a couple of children, but this daughter had been working at a job she really enjoyed. But the mother was saying, I'm not telling you what to do, but these kids are with you such a short time, and you really don't want to miss any of it. And the girl quit her job, and I'm glad she did, because I think it'll be good for everybody, ultimately. Now, obviously, you have to decide for yourselves, but we love our women so much, and we want to protect and take care of them. And there is a submissive idea here that's, I think, very important. A woman who won't submit to her husband is going to have an awful time submitting to God. So she needs to submit as God has designed the order. But you know, there's something in a godly woman that wants to submit to a man she admires. And I worry about our women sometimes when they get under a powerful male-dominated environment in the workplace, because a woman responds to that. And sometimes she can be easily abused. She'll be exposed at best to innuendo and at worst to sexual involvement. A woman needs the saving sense of protection that a husband and a home provide. And this is so not only for the safety of your family. The Apostle Paul says it's also so that the word of God be not blasphemed and dishonored. It's not just for you and me, it's for God and His word. The honor of the Lord's word is at stake here. Because as I said this morning, unbelievers can read this text and they can see whether we're obeying it or not. So, excellent question, Becky. I really appreciate it. And if there's nothing further, we'll go on because we got sidelined a little bit. Thank you, Jason. We were talking about 1 Peter 3:7, but we sidelined that into a discussion of the five love languages, and we had only covered two of the five. So if you're the same people from before, and I'm sure you are, just remember with me what the first two were. Number one, words of affirmation. Number two, quality time. These are languages that speak to our spouse, whether male or female. We can speak these languages to them and help them feel as loved as they really are. Number three is receiving gifts. Now, some sort of gift giving seems to be part of every culture. You need to be thinking of somebody a little bit to be giving them a gift. And the gift itself is sort of a symbol of that thought. Mothers can remember back many decades sometimes to their children bringing them a flower from the yard. Even if it was a flower they didn't want picked, they appreciate the sentiment in the mind of that child. Gifts are visual symbols of love. Most weddings include giving and receiving of rings. An outward and visible sign of an inward and wonderful gift, we sometimes say. Symbols have an emotional impact, an emotional value. But symbols are more important to some people than they are to others. Giving gifts is one of the easiest love languages to learn. Gifts can be purchased or found or made. You can purchase a beautiful card for just a few dollars, or you can make a great card for nothing. If you have trouble knowing what gift to give, you can make a list of all the gifts that your spouse has expressed excitement about receiving through the years, given to by you or by other people. And that will give you an idea of the kinds of things that he or she enjoys receiving. If he or she has been critical of your gifts in the past, and almost nothing you have given has been acceptable, then receiving gifts is almost certainly not the primary love language of this person. But this gift of receiving, language of receiving gifts has a complicator because it touches our attitudes about money. And in marriage, our attitudes about money are very important. We each have individual perceptions. We come to the marriage with individual perceptions about the purposes of money, and we've all got emotional associations connected with money. Some of us have a spending orientation. We just feel good spending. Others of us have a saving and investing perspective, and we feel good when we're saving, and investing and spending is very uncomfortable. Now, if you're a spender, you're not going to have much difficulty with the idea of purchasing gifts for your spouse. But if you're a saver, you may have some emotional resistance to the idea of spending money as an expression of love. But if you discover that your spouse's primary love language is receiving gifts, then you need to understand that purchasing gifts may be among the very best investments that you can possibly make, because you're investing in your relationship. You're filling your spouse's emotional love tank, as it were. And with a full love tank, your spouse may be able and willing to reciprocate to you in a language that you will understand. When both of the partner's emotional needs are being met, your relationship can well take on a whole new dimension. If you're a saver, you're always going to be a saver, most likely. But you can't make a better investment than investing in loving your spouse. There is also the intangible gift of self, or just the gift of your presence. Joyce was talking to me during the break this morning, which stretched into a long break, but she was talking about this a poem that she has about a little boy. He found out, go ahead and give it away. The poem would be better, but I don't have it yet. But some of you may have read this, and she was saying this poem said that this little boy went out, and I think he worked doing some things in the neighborhood so he could earn enough money to buy an hour of his father's time. I don't know if I could have read the poem without sobbing anyway, because that's a remarkable thing. Just to give the gift of time to somebody in your family, being there when your spouse needs you, speaks very loudly to one whose primary love language is receiving gifts. Physical presence in time of crisis is very important to a person like that. Your presence there is a symbol of your love. You take away that symbol and the sense of love tends to evaporate. If the physical presence of your spouse is important to you, then you need to verbalize that to your spouse. In fact, there are lots of things we need to kindly verbalize to our spouses. I don't know how many women I've had say to me, and men too sometimes, but not as much, but many women through the years have said something like, well, if he loved me, he'd just know. Well, that's not true, and that's not fair. You're a woman, he's a man, how's he going to just know? Just explain to him, and if he loves you, he will listen and try to do better in the future than he has done in the past. Don't expect him to read your mind. If your spouse says, I really want you to be there with me at this event or that event, then take that request seriously. From your perspective, it may not be important. You may not be able to see why it's necessary for you to be there at all. But if you don't go, you may be sending a message that you don't intend. At the heart of love is the spirit of giving. All five of these love languages involve giving, but for some people, receiving gifts, receiving visible symbols of love, speaks the very loudest to them. So learning the right love language is the key to helping your spouse feel the love that you feel for him or her. Number four, acts of service. Acts of service. Doing things that you know your spouse would like to have you do. Mowing the yard, cooking a meal, Jesus washing the disciples' feet, serving one another in love. We need to make requests of each other rather than demands. Criticism and demands tend to drive wedges between you, as you know. And with enough criticism, your spouse may do what you want, but probably it won't be as an expression of love. You cannot create the will to love in another person. You can only make sure that you have it yourself. Each of us has to decide, and we have to decide regularly, whether to love or not to love our spouse. If we choose to love, then expressing it in this way in the way that our spouse requests of us will make our love most effective emotionally for them. The commandment is, husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. Why the last phrase? Be not bitter against them? Because with the proximity over the years and decades, there can easily be a bitterness that builds up. We need to work on letting the love wipe out that accumulation of bitterness. Requests, in this context of acts of service, give direction to the love. Demands stop the flow of love. What we do for one another before marriage is no indication of what we will do for one another after marriage. Before marriage, we're carried along by the idea of being in love. After marriage, we revert to being the people we were before we, quote, fell in love. So our actions are influenced then by the models that our parents set in front of us and by our own personality, maybe our own genetic makeup even, and our own perceptions of love. Our actions and reactions then are caught up in our own emotions and needs and desires. And there's only one thing certain about our behavior. It won't be the same as when we're caught up in the initial throes of being in love. I never will forget when Lynn and I were going together. I was up at Paul Croy's and Mary Virginia's house in North Missouri. It was late, and it was probably already about midnight. And Lynn was way over in Topeka. She'd just gotten home from somewhere. And I was going to stay all night with the Croys, but I called Lynn just to see how things were going. We talked for a while, and I couldn't wait. I just took off. And as I was going out the door, I heard Paul chuckling, saying, "Young love. Young love." Well, you know, that's great. That's a great feeling. But if it evaporates, we can keep things in line. We can keep things in harmony through following these ideas of the love languages. And it's very important that we do this. My spouse's criticisms about my behavior provide me with the clearest clue to what her primary love language is. People tend to criticize their spouse most loudly in the area where they themselves have the deepest emotional need. Their criticism is a rather ineffective way of just pleading for love. So we need to look beyond the words in the criticism very often and see what's really being said. What is the plea for love, really? What does it mean? What would help them to feel love? And if we understand that, then that may help us to process their criticism in a more productive way. Quite often, their actual criticism isn't what they mean in their heart at all. And that's very confusing. At least it is to me. But we need to come to terms with this. Criticism often needs clarification. Initiating these conversations may eventually turn the criticism into a request rather than a demand. A doormat can serve you, but a doormat can't love you. If you're trying to manipulate your spouse by guilt, well, if you were a good husband, you'd do this for me. That's not the language of love. Neither is coercion by fear. You do this or you'll be sorry. That's not the language of love. In the area of acts and service, it may be necessary to re-examine some of the stereotypes that we might have, one or both of us might have, about male and female roles. As long as we stay within the biblical model, the cultural model can be thrown out the door. There are a lot of assumptions that many people have about male and female roles that didn't come from the Bible. All right, number five and last of the love languages is physical touch. Physical touch is a way of communicating emotional love. And I had planned to talk about that in relation to children. I don't know, we're not going to get to a lot of those types of things. But we have shown, there have been actual studies that have shown, that babies that are held and hugged and kissed develop a healthier emotional life than those that are just left for long periods of time without physical contact. People used to bring their young children to Jesus just so he could touch them, lay his hands upon them. Mark chapter 10, verse 13. He took them in his arms, he put his hands on them, and he blessed them. Wise parents are touching parents. You may have been raised in a home where touching was just not the norm. People didn't touch each other unless it was absolutely necessary. Many homes have been like that through the years. But we do need to touch one another, whether it comes naturally or not. If it doesn't come naturally, we need to do that. Because for some people, especially, physical touch is their primary language of love. Some people don't even feel like they've had a conversation with you unless they've touched you. Have you noticed that? Other people never touch you. But there are many people who will hug you or kiss you or at least touch you on the arm. It's a point of contact for them to be sure we're connecting in the words that we're saying to each other. And without it, without physical touch, many people feel unloved. With it, they feel secure. And this holds true in their love of their spouse. Sexual intercourse is only one dialect in the language of physical touch. There are receptors all over the human body, even though they're not evenly spread. They're all over the body. And touch can communicate. It can communicate either love or hate. A slap in the face is detrimental to any child, but it's devastating to a child whose primary love language is physical touch. Whereas a tender hug communicates love to any child, but it shouts love to the child whose primary love language is physical touch. Lovingly touching your spouse almost anywhere on their body can be an expression of love. Not all touches were created equal, however, and some are going to bring more pleasure to your spouse than others. And your best instructor in this is your spouse. If it's your wife, she's the one that you're seeking to love and show your love to. She knows best what she perceives as a loving touch. So it's not out of line at all to talk with her about this. Learn to speak her particular love dialect within her own love language. She may find that some touches are uncomfortable or some touches are irritating. So don't make the mistake of thinking that the touch that brings pleasure to you is also going to bring pleasure to her. Ask her about it. Communicate with her about it. Some touches require only a moment and they're done just in passing. Other touches like a back rub or a massage are explicit and may require a lot of time and full attention. Implicit love requires little time, but a lot of thought is required if physical touch is not your primary love language, because you just don't remember to do it. You just don't think to do it, especially if you didn't grow up in a touchy-feely type family. Once you discover that physical touch is the primary love language of your spouse, you're limited only by your imagination on ways to express love. And if you're not accustomed to holding hands in public, and I say this especially to the men, if you're not accustomed to holding hands in public, you may find that you can fill your spouse's love tank just as you walk through the campground or through a parking lot somewhere, just by holding her hand in a public manner, because this may communicate for her to others that you care for her. Hugging your wife before she goes shopping may not only express love, but may bring her home earlier with less credit card slips. So it works to everybody's benefit. You know, whatever there is of me on earth resides in my body. To touch my body is to touch me. To withdraw from my body is to distance yourself from me emotionally. In our society, shaking hands is a way of communicating openly and openness to another individual. When a man refuses to shake hands with another man, it communicates that things are not right in their relationship. All societies have some sort of a physical touching as a means of social greeting. In Europe, the bear hug and kiss has served for a long time the same basic function as our shaking hands. I have a mental image of right after we got a TV, our very first TV when I was a boy. I have this image of, and I don't even know if it really happened this way, but the image I have in mind, and maybe I was in somebody else's house, but I think I saw on TV, Nikita Khrushchev, the premier of the Soviet Union, coming down the stairs on the airplane the old-fashioned way when they came right down on the runway from the stairs on the plane, and grabbing President Eisenhower in a bear hug and kissing him on both cheeks. I had never seen anything like that in my life. In my world, men didn't do that. I had never seen it. My grandfathers were rocks. You know, those old guys that really built this country, they felt like they had to be hard. They wouldn't even tell you they loved you. They might say, "We love you," but that was as close as they came. It was never, "I love you," because they were inured against that type of thing. So it was amazing to me, but it was somebody from a different culture. There is, though, this. Almost instinctively, in times of crisis, we hug one another across genders and everywhere else. Physical touch is a powerful communicator of love. And if your wife's primary love language is physical touch, it's very important that you hold her when she cries. And you don't even have to say anything. Just hold her when she cries. Most women cry occasionally. It's a vent, a very godly vent for them that they need. Just hold her when she cries. Took me years to figure out. I don't even have to say anything. Just, to me, it's about talking. You know, life is, a lot of my life is about talking. I don't even have to say anything. Just the hug communicates. Well, from this little vignette that we've given you here, some of you are going to instantaneously know what your primary love language is, and some of you will automatically know what the primary love language of your spouse is. Some of you have thought about this before. For others, it's not that easy. A lot of men assume that physical touch is their love language because they like sex so much. But if he doesn't enjoy physical touch at other times and in non-sexual ways, it may not be his love language at all. Sexual desire is quite different from his emotional need to feel loved. Sexual intercourse alone will not meet his need to feel loved. His wife must seek his primary love language as well. And when we each seek and then speak the primary love language of the other, and we each keep the other's love tanks full, usually then, the sexual aspect of our relationship will take care of itself, just as a natural byproduct of the love that we share for each other. Most sexual problems, I've been talking to people about this for half a century, most sexual problems in marriage have little to do with physical technique, and they have everything to do with meeting emotional needs. So you can ask yourself, or ask your spouse, what is your primary love language? What makes you feel the most loved by your spouse? What is it that you desire from me above everything else? What does your spouse do or say? Or what does your spouse fail to do or say that hurts you the most deeply? If your deepest pain is the critical, judgmental words of your spouse, then maybe your primary love language is words of affirmation. And your greatest hurt may be the greatest clue as to what your love language actually is. So you look back over your marriage and you ask, what is it that I have most often requested of my spouse? The nagging that takes place in a marriage on either side is often just an effort to get your love language spoken and to get fulfilled in that way. So examine what you do or say to express love to your spouse. Chances are you're doing for them what you wish they would do for you. You're trying to fulfill, as we said at the beginning of this section, the principle of the golden rule in Matthew 7:14. But often we're trying to fulfill it with too blunt of an application. We're doing for them what we wish they would do for us. You know, I used to, early in the days of our marriage, when I would travel some way, I guess it was early in the days of parenthood, because Lynn almost always went with me before we had children. But when we started having children, I guess especially when the kids got up to the age where they were starting into school, Lynn stayed home with them. But I would find in my luggage that she had packed little notes, little love notes that she had written. Sometimes there'd be one on top, and then there'd be another two or three pairs of underwear down that I would find in the middle of the week. Little notes. It took me years to realize, well, she probably likes little notes left for her, because she's leaving them for me. They were nice, but I don't know if they meant to me. I'll tell you, I was over in the Philippines recently. I'll tell you what, something that meant something to me. And it wasn't even intended, I think. But I was in the Philippines recently. We were on, I don't know, I never know what island we're on. But we'd been up all night traveling, and we got to a place. We're sitting in a guy's living room. He said, would you like to take a shower? And that was like saying, would you like $1 million? I went in the shower and came back out, got dug around in my suitcase that Lynn had packed. I pulled out this shirt. No place else to put it on, so I took it outside in the wonderful weather, and I put on this shirt. But on this shirt, I found one of Lynn's hairs. Long, beautiful gray hair. And I went home for a minute. You know, that was just a wonderful reminder, unintended though. You know, I don't think she put it in there on purpose, but just unintended though it was a wonderful reminder. You never know what's going to spark that kind of reminiscence and what kind of thing is going to mean something to you. You look back over the years of your marriage and you just ask, what have I needed? What have I requested? What have I felt like I need? And ask, what have we nagged each other about? Examine what you do or say. Write these things down and examine them. See if they change over time. Write down what you think your primary language of love is, and then write the other four down in the order of importance to you. And if two of these love languages seem to be of equal importance to you, it may be that you're bilingual. Maybe you've got two of them. And that only makes it easier on your spouse, because if they have two choices, it's either one of those is going to strongly communicate love to you. What can we do to help each other feel loved? That's the issue. And I guess that's about all. We've got 2 minutes. Anybody want to say anything? Well, I wanted to just read. We do have one? Okay, Gene's got something. Go ahead.
Could you read that article you read this morning about why God made woman?
What?
How God made woman, the different softness and stuff.
Yeah.
Could you read that again?
Oh, read it again? I threw those things away. I was done with them. Yeah, about the word Isha, it meant soft. So that was Adam's first impression of Eve, that she was soft. The word translated woman is Isha in the Hebrew tongue. Oh, that one. Okay. All right. Here we go. Thank you. Thanks for the clarification there. And this is folly, in a sense, because it's a false account. I want to make that clear. When we're saying God said, I want to make clear, this is just to make a point of emphasis here. God did not really say these things. This did not really happen. But I think and hope that we all understand that. Here was what I think I said this morning. God talked with Adam in the cool of the day and asked God, why did you make the woman so beautiful? And God replied, to make sure you would love her. After a full day with Eve, God talked with Adam in the cool of the day and asked God, why did you make her skin so soft and smooth? And God replied, to make sure you would love her. The next day, Adam asked God, why did you make her voice so melodious and pleasant? And God replied, to make sure you would love her. And the next day, God came to Adam a little bit frustrated in his tone. He said, God, Eve is beautiful. She's such a joy to be with and to talk to, but she doesn't think logically at all. Why did you make her so illogical? And God's reply, simple and to the point, was to make sure she'd love you. Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Who?
Okay.
Dan.
The five love languages are on the web also.
Okay.
And I have used those with pre-marriage and marriage counseling, because you can go to the web, five love languages, and you can take the test online, and then it will send you information about the love languages that are powerful to
okay.
you.
Okay. Good. Thank you for that. Now, for a while there, when couples were in my office that I was getting ready to marry, I would give them each a copy of that book. I thought that much of it, because it's succinct, clear, to the point. Thank you for that. Is there anything else? No? Okay, I'll close with a poem. It's called So Long As There Are Homes. So long as there are homes to which men turn at close of day, so long as there are homes where children are, where women stay, if love and loyalty and faith be found across these sills, a stricken nation can recover from its gravest ills. So long as there are homes where fires burn and there is bread, so long as there are homes where lamps are lit and prayers are said, although a people falter through the dark and nations grope, with God Himself back of these little homes, we still can hope.